ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we discuss how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also discuss why a plant-based diet is not only the best thing that you can do for the planet, but it's also the best thing that you can do for your health and the animals.
So if you're concerned about the planet, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, if you're concerned about your health, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas. Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Sherry Kolb, who's a professor of law at Cornell and author of the book Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger. That's coming up a little later on the show, but first some news.
From the news feed, the Dodo, in an encouraging move indicative of a change in the way non-humans are regarded in society, lawmakers in a French National Assembly committee voted recently to officially elevate the legal status of animals from mere personal property to that of sentient living being. The law must still pass the full Assembly and Senate, but organizers are optimistic that it will move forward, given the antiquated language in place now. Under current civil law, animals receive the same treatment as objects. Proponents of the amendment to reconcile the legal characterization and emotional value of animals admit that the legislation is largely symbolic, but it's nevertheless very significant that it has the overwhelming support of the French people. According to the Agence France-Presse, a poll found that 89% of the country approves of the change. Since 2009, the European Union governing body has officially considered animals sentient beings under the Lisbon Treaty, though some national governments have been late in updating their laws to reflect it.
The Humane Society of the U.S. reports that six California sea lions were killed at the Bonneville Dam in the Columbia River simply for doing what comes naturally, eating fish. Under a permit issued by the National Marine Fisheries Service, the states of Oregon and Washington used lethal injections to kill six sea lions who were branded and marked for death in 2013. State managers have predicted a spring salmon run return of over 200,000 fish in the Columbia River Basin. Under a court-approved quota system, commercial, recreational, and tribal fishermen would be allowed to take up to 12% of these fish. Although the state and federal fishery managers consider this level sustainable, the states of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho have claimed that salmon predation by sea lions at the Bonneville Dam, which averages less than 1% over the last 3 years, is unacceptable and requires immediate lethal reprisals. According to management policy, a sea lion is deemed predatory and marked for death if the animal is individually identifiable, seen on any 5 days at the Bonneville Dam, and is observed eating at least one fish on one of those 5 days. Up to 92 of these sea lions can be killed in a single year. The Army Corps of Engineers, which monitors predation at the Bonneville Dam, found that the sea lions at the dam 1 year were often different individuals than those that were there in previous years. Killing sea lions is pointless because new sea lions come even as the others are killed. In addition, in the most recent biannual report to Congress, the National Marine Fisheries Service reported that all of the spring runs affected by sea lion predation are either stable or increasing. In reality, a number of factors are responsible for the decline and slow recovery of salmon in the Columbia River. These include dams that block passage and kill fish, ocean and river salmon fishing levels, habitat that is degraded, and hatchery operations that release fish that both eat and compete with native salmon. Sharon Young, Marine Wildlife Protection Field Director for the Humane Society, said that killing a sea lion won't help salmon recovery. Sea lions come and go from the dam. Killing them simply distracts from the fact that the major factors affecting salmon recovery remain largely unaddressed.
Last month, the Montana Supreme Court affirmed the decision of a lower court allowing wild bison to roam free outside the northern boundary of Yellowstone National Park. The ruling upholds a February 2012 decision by state agencies to allow bison seasonal access to important winter and early spring habitat outside the north boundary of Yellowstone Park until May 1st of each year. The ruling rebuffs demands by some livestock producers and their allies to require aggressive hazing and slaughtering of bison that enter the Gardner Basin area of Yellowstone National Park in winter and early spring in search of the forage they need to survive. In two lawsuits filed in May 2011, the Park County Stock Growers Association and the Montana Farm Bureau Federation sought to block implementation of the new policy and require state officials to adhere to outdated plans for bison slaughter. Thankfully, those efforts failed. This new ruling by the Montana Supreme Court protects bison who are outside the park during the winter, but after May 1st, it becomes open season on bison again. And the National Park Service is still under obligation, because of a lawsuit filed by the state of Montana, to keep the size of the Yellowstone bison herd down to 3,000 animals. Right now, the herd is a bit over 4,000. Bison are the only native wildlife species still unnaturally confined to the political boundaries of Yellowstone National Park for any part of the year. As recently as 2008, more than 1,400 bison, about one-third of the current size of Yellowstone bison population, were captured inside Yellowstone Park and slaughtered by the National Park Service. The whole situation is occurring because Montana cattle ranchers don't want Yellowstone bison eating the grass on federal land grazing allotments. Please contact the superintendent of Yellowstone, the director of the National Park Service, and or your congressional representative, and tell them that the National Park Service should be protecting wildlife, not slaughtering them. Stay with us. Coming up next on ACT Radio, we feature a conversation with Sherry Kolb, who's professor of law at Cornell University Law School, where she teaches courses in animal rights and criminal procedure. She's also the author of the book, Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger? And Other Questions People Ask Vegans. That's next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas, Sherry Kolb. Thanks for being with us on the show, Sherry.
Thank you for having me.
Sherry, can we start out by having you tell our listeners a little bit about how you got involved in being a vegan?
Sure. It was really there were a lot of contributing factors, so it wasn't one thing, but I guess I've always really adored animals, and, you know, I was the one in the building growing up who knew all the names of the dogs, but never any of the humans. Oh, that's Toto's mom, you know, and that was, that was how I interacted with the people who lived in my building. And although at the time I really didn't make any connection with, you know, with the, what I was eating at all or what I was wearing, and it was really just the animals people had in their homes. And then there was a summer in Holland when two things were happening at once. One is I was reading When Elephants Weep by Jeffrey Mason.
Yeah. Good book.
And that really just spoke to me, you know, in finding out about animal emotion. And I suddenly kind of began to see a connection between animals I knew had emotions, like dogs and cats, and the animals who were making their way onto my plate. And at the same time, I while in Holland, I would pass by this small farm each day, and I started noticing the animals there in a different way. And a few of them would come running over each time I would pass by, and they were the same ones each day. So I started seeing them as individuals, which was a change. And so that's when I began to take certain animals off my plate. It was sort of a somewhat arbitrary process, but I think that not unusual, where I started with the warm-blooded animals. and then years later, I was on faculty with Gary Francione, and so I began reading some of his work and started to have kind of an intellectual foundation for some of what had been more of an emotional, intuitive sense about animals. And then I went on a trip to a foreign country where I ordered fish for dinner, and they brought out a live fish. And at first I was like, what is that thing that's moving? And then I was horrified, and I turned away, and you know, I think the idea was to show how fresh the fish would be, and that's just not something that's common in the United States. But it was, you know, it was common in this particular place, and suddenly it struck me, hey, I'm ordering the execution of this fish, and this fish is suffering, and it's horrible. And then, again, in the same week, I was noticing fish in aquariums that, you know, I'm not a fan now of aquariums, but at the time I would notice that they would come over and they would look, and I wasn't feeding them, because that's always sort of, oh, yeah, they just want food. And that's kind of how a lot of animal emotion is written off.
Well, it's true of my cat.
Right. Well, you know, we all need food, but yeah. And so, you know, and it's sort of this journey, and then at some point I just stopped. I became vegetarian, but I didn't know that much about veganism. But knowing Gary Francione and reading some of his work, I started to see that it was somewhat arbitrary to distinguish between the flesh and the secretions of these animals who are all going to be slaughtered. And so I made that final leap about 8 years ago. I became vegan.
That's great. Yeah.
That seems to be a common path for many vegans, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Let's talk for a moment about the classes you teach at Cornell. I'd like to know what kind of material you cover in your animal rights law courses.
Sure. Well, I just teach one course in animal rights, and basically it's really kind of an animal ethics course, because in my view, the law really doesn't do much for animals at this point, and it's actually hard, I think, for the law to do much at a point when almost nobody actually would support that, you know, treating animals as something other than resources. So what we do is we look at why the law treats animals as resources. So we look at the philosophical literature. We look at, you know, sort of Descartes a little bit, and some of the neo-Cartesians who acknowledge that animals do feel things but say that they don't have language, so their experiences don't count in some sense.
And, well, we're learning that's wrong, yes, aren't we?
Yes, we are. We are learning that's wrong. But, of course, you don't need language in order for your experiences to count anyway, so I wouldn't even honor the premise of that. But we sort of look at all of the errors, in a sense, of the empirical and philosophical errors that have led to where we are now. So I actually have people come in to talk about nutrition. We look at the China study because I think that there's a really widespread mistaken belief that we need animal products for our health when the opposite is true. So I also have a vegan chef come in and do a food demo.
Wow.
That's nice.
For my students. Yeah. And just so they can see, because I think there's also this misconception that food is not fun if it's not animal-based. And so they get to have a delicious meal. And I actually bake each week for my students so they can see that also if you're, you know, into pastries and things like that, that all of that is still really available to you as a vegan.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I was just giving an Earth Day presentation over at the U.S. Consulate in Juarez, Mexico, about veganism and climate change. And the very first question I was asked is, well, what would you eat on a normal day? I mean, what could you eat? You know? And then, you know, I said, well, you know, I have oatmeal with, and then for breakfast, you know, this pretty mundane, but every day things that you can eat. And I told everybody it's just a matter of changing out your fridge and your pantry. It's not a matter of not eating something. It's just eating something different. You know?
Yeah. Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I gave my students an example the other day of I was driving my car and I couldn't get the GPS to go off, and so it kept on telling me to make turns that didn't correspond to where I wanted to go. And, you know, you get into a habit, and so you think, oh, I'm supposed to go right. The GPS is telling me to go right. But at some point you decide, well, actually, I have somewhere I want to go, and I shouldn't follow just because the GPS is telling me to drive into a river.
Was that an analogy of following medical advice about we need meat?
Well, it could be. I think it could be an analogy to so many
yeah.
things.
Yeah. I have to tell you, I found your book to be very interesting. We're talking about Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger and Other Questions People Ask Vegans. I thought it was going to be a light read with a title like that, but it was far from a light read. Many of the questions that you cover, I thought I knew the answers to most of them, and I was close. You went into some detail that I'd never thought about before. It's a wonderful book. Thank you for writing it, Sherry.
Oh, thank you so much.
So let's go through a few of the questions. I'd like to start with, what about plants? Don't they have feelings too?
I don't think they do. I should start by saying anything is possible, but a lot of the arguments people make for the notion that plants are sentient tend to revolve around the fact that they have adaptive mechanisms for resisting predators and disease.
Right.
And so, and it struck me that we have that too, and that goes on without our consciousness at all. So, for example, if you inhale a pathogen, your immune system, if it's working well, will mobilize a response to that that is very effective and quite complicated in the same way as, you know, plants notifying other plants of a predator might be. But you're not conscious of it. It's not something that either manifests or evidences our sentience. It's just something that we do separate from our sentience. And so I don't think when it happens for a plant, it evidences or manifests the plant's sentience either. And plants don't have a lot of the things that are used for detecting in a conscious way. It doesn't have a brain or a central nervous system. And, you know, so while I think we, you know, it's possible that they are sentient and we might learn something someday that suggests that they are, at the moment at least, we don't have evidence that they are.
Perhaps we vegans are just in denial about this, though. As Buddha said, even the stones will one day reach Buddhahood.
That's possible. And, you know, one of the things that's useful, I think, to remember as a vegan is that even if we decide that plants are, or if we decide, if we find that plants are sentient, and we're still really minimizing the harm to plants mm-hmm. by eating them directly than by eating, rather than eating farmed animals, where we need to give them many more times the amount of plant-based food in order to create them.
So we're being kinder to plants by eating them directly than by passing many more of them through animals first.
Exactly.
And what about pleasure in eating? That seems to be a basis, really, for so many people to try and say that, you know, they can't go without eating meat.
Or they can't live without cheese.
Right, right. Well, I think the cheese thing actually has its own sort of world. But in general, when people say that, oh, I could never give up meat or I could never give up animal products, I think that they're operating on an assumption that they have an imaginary idea of what it would be like to be vegan, and they imagine sitting around with some sprouts and you know, and maybe
oatmeal.
I had oatmeal this morning, Liz.
With sprouts in it.
Your listeners are going to think all we eat is oatmeal. you know, sprouts and oatmeal. and so I think they figure, well, I can't just live a life without pleasure, and nobody really wants to do that. So if you say, here, I have something to tell you, and if I tell you, you're going to want to start living in a very ascetic, pleasure-free way, they're going to run. So my response is that regardless of what the moral obligation might be in a world where you could have had to choose between nonviolence and pleasure, we're not living in that world. There's so much abundance and bounty in the plant and, I guess, plant and fungus kingdom, although that sounds really disgusting.
I love mushrooms.
I love mushrooms, too. I just didn't say this. I have a plant and fungus-based diet. Somehow even worse than plant-based. So, you know, so I really try in the book and in general when people say this to me to point out just how many wonderful foods there are. And really now there are so many vegan restaurants which are, you know that there are non-vegans eating them because people come in with fur coats on.
And right.
So, you know, so that's sort of both good news and bad news. But the good news is that obviously the food is fantastic. And I mean, one of the things I suggest in the book is that we're really very bad at imagining what would make us happy.
That's true.
Yeah, and so when people say, oh, well, you know, and this is typical, people will pick a job where they'll make a lot of money, even if they have to commute for an hour, and they think, well, the money will make me more happy than the commute will make me unhappy. And it turns out that as a general matter, that's false. People are actually miserable in their commute, and the particular amount of money that they make doesn't seem to compensate for that. So, to some degree, I think when if you ask vegans, like, are you happy? People who have decided and committed to it, are you happy or do you miss being a non-vegan? People typically will say, oh, my God, I just wish I'd gone vegan sooner.
Yeah.
Rather than, oh, yeah, God, I wish I could have cheese. And then cheese, the cheese thing is, of course, there's now non-vegan cheeses that are great. And uh-huh. Miyoko Shinner did a food demo that I attended last year, and it was just unbelievably good. But I think there is this, at least biological feature, and Liz, you would know more about this, but about casein, and that maybe people have a kind of casomorphins, that casein breaks up into a potential opiate that could perhaps explain why some people seem to hang on to cheese the longest.
It's an addiction, yeah.
Well, and I mean, I think people just love fatty food. I mean, let's face it, we vegans love vegan cheese because it's full of fat, too.
Yeah, that's true.
Fat and salt.
So you get fat and salt and sugar together, and that's pretty delicious.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I try to point out to people, too, a lot of the time. They're like, oh, well, this is vegan cheesecake. It must be good for you. And I'm like, wait a minute here. Stop.
Right.
Take a minute here.
Yeah, there is that funny misconception.
There's something else I wanted to ask about. It seemed to me in your book that you don't think that welfare reforms are necessarily a good thing. Let me present my case, and then you can refute it. You quote Norm Phelps a couple of times, and I remember an article he wrote saying that whenever there is an expose because of some undercover investigation of factory farm conditions, there's a corresponding dip in consumption of that particular animal for a little while. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that these exposés make people aware of the conditions that animals live under in factory farms, and it's a good thing, perhaps for the welfare campaign to fail would be the best thing of all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, how do you respond to that?
Well, that's interesting. I think a welfare campaign and any kind of sort of campaign for a legal change can succeed by failing in the sense that it can raise awareness and make people outraged and things like that. And so that is an upside, I think, of some of these campaigns. But and let me just say I love Norm Phelps' book about the dominion of love, and I think it's a wonderful, it gives you a wonderful window into the Bible that rebuts a lot of the sort of conception of the Bible as supporting animal harm. But where I'm skeptical, and I think it's an empirical question that's very hard to answer, but I worry that the welfare campaigns, in a sense, say, okay, so we accept that animals are used, but this is how they ought to be used instead of the way they're currently being used. And that even though most of the advocates who press for these welfare changes don't believe that, I think the audience does, and that it's really useful to say to your audience, you know, I think that all animal exploitation is wrong, rather than to give them the impression that there's some kind of ethical way that they can use animals. And that's where I worry, because I think what happens, I remember when I heard about something going on with pigs, and this was years before I had any kind of consciousness about this. And at the time, I used to buy pig's ears for my dogs, and so I switched to cow ears, you know, and that was, and so, I mean, that might be the sort of thing that, I think Norm Phelps would say, oh, people are switching, are reducing that animal product, but I think when you're operating in a non-vegan framework, that the tendency is to replace with another animal product rather than to, you know, replace it with plants, because you don't know about plants yet. I mean, that's sort of part of the problem, and so, I mean, when I went vegetarian, suddenly my pizza consumption just rose to the roof. And so, you know, I feel as though, you know, the combination of potentially just saying, oh, well, now I'm not going to eat a pig. I'll eat a cow instead, or I'll eat a chicken, that's not really help. That's sort of sideways movement rather than, and also just the message of that there's a correct way, or that, you know, this is, that the, if we gas the chickens instead of electrocuting them, then we've done our job by chickens.
But
or like I had a friend that was telling me, well, I know that the food I eat, you know, they're raised humanely. Mm. And then and she's like, I love to eat lamb, but I only get humanely raised lamb. And I'm like,
right.
And I said, well, you know, maybe humanely right up to the point of where they slit its throat. And she was like,
yeah.
Liz, how can you say something like that? And I'm like, well, let's be honest with ourselves. You know,
right.
If you're going on and on about how humane something is, let's think the whole process through, you know.
Oh, exactly. There was, I think, an onion. Do you know the onion?
Yeah.
So they had something about, like, the guy waxing poetic about how he loves his animals, and then he slits their throats, and, you know, and it's just, and they're, of course, they're babies, right, lambs. And it's the idea of humane. Mainly killing an infant. There's something very jarring about that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if billions of animals are going to be confined in miserable conditions and slaughtered, shouldn't they have some comfort while they're being imprisoned?
Oh,
we can't turn the world vegan overnight.
Right. I know, absolutely. I mean, of course they should have comfort. And one of the things that I find really appealing is there's an organization, Toronto Pig Save, and one of the things they do is to approach trucks headed for slaughter when the truck is at a red light and to give water to the pigs inside, and then they film it, and it's just heartbreaking, you know.
Okay.
You see this, and of course, like I'm glad that they're doing that in part because this is maybe the only moment of kindness that these animals experience in their lives. So, it's not that I oppose doing kindness for them. It's just that when Toronto Pig Save does it, it's a way of telling people this is so wrong, and it's wrong in so many ways, and that the campaigns. Can convey maybe inadvertently the message that we're making things okay for the animals, and oftentimes the public relations benefit long precedes the actual change in the law. So people think, I want to do this for animals today, but actually, even though the New York Times had something not that long ago about, you know, they wish they all could be California hens, talking about how great it is to be a hen in California because the battery cages are larger, or their colony cages or whatever. And
colony cages.
Yeah, and the thing is that's actually not even gone into effect yet. So, you know, but people now, you know, say, oh, yeah, well, I'm in California, so I feel good about the animal products I buy. So I think that to some degree, I mean, the illusion of it is so powerful that it takes hold even before the law goes into effect.
We've been talking with Sherry Kolb, professor of law at Cornell University and author of the book Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger and Other Questions People Ask Vegans. And Sherry, we didn't cover many of the questions at all. Would you join us for our next show so we can talk a little more about this important issue?
Absolutely.
Okay, great.
Thanks for being on the show.
If you'd like to learn more about a plant-based diet, you can visit the webpage of the Vegetarian Society of El Paso at vsep.org. You can also learn about our spring dinner featuring Nick Cooney. Nick is the Director of Education at Mercy for Animals and the author of Change of Heart, What Psychology Can Teach Us About Spreading Social Change. The dinner is Saturday, May 10th at 6 p.m. at Sunland Park Holiday Inn. You need to make reservations in advance, so be sure to visit vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACK Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen button.
Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.
He said to her, I'd like a cheeseburger, and I might like a milkshake as well. She said to him, I can't give you either. And he said,